They are married with children. She is the chair of the Plant Genomics Program and professor of SAME at the University of California, Davis. He is the manager of the UC Davis Student Farm and its instructor of organic agriculture. Together, they suggest a sustainable future made possible by genetically engineered organic food. Their suggestion, therefore, leads us to ask, should we allow genetic engineering into organic agriculture?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 663rd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Tokyo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hi.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello, everyone.
Folks, they are the Romeo and Juliet of academic agriculture. She is the head of the UC Davis Plant Genomics Program and its professor of SAME. He is the manager of the UC Davis Student Farm and its instructor of organic agriculture. Her genetic engineering and his organic farming are forbidden by law. Specifically, Section 205.105 of the United States Department of Agriculture's National Organic Program, which states, to be sold or labeled as 100% organic, food must be produced and handled without the use of methods used to genetically modify organisms or influence their growth and development by means that are not possible under natural conditions or processes. But outside of the lab and classroom, Pamela Ronald and Raul Adamczyk are married with children, and being as close can be, have come up with a proposal which they have packaged in a book entitled Organically Grown and Genetically Engineered, The Future of Food, The Food of the Future. Their proposal leads us to ask, should we allow genetic engineering into organic agriculture? And who better to explore the parameters of this question than Raul and Pamela? So let's say hello to them. Pamela, let's start with you. Pamela Ronald, chair of the Plant Genomics Program and professor at UC Davis. Welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning.
Glad to have you aboard. You've been on the road for a while, haven't you?
Now and then, yes.
So tell us a little bit about the Plant Genomics Program and what you do there.
Well, I'm actually in the Department of Plant Pathology, and I've been a professor there for about 18 years. Mm-hmm. And my lab is trying to understand the genes that make plants, and specifically rice, tolerant of stresses and diseases.
Mm-hmm. And you've had some significant success in that regard, developing rice that can survive flooding. How on earth did you do that?
Well, thanks. Actually, a friend and colleague of mine about 15 years ago, Dave McKill at the International Rice Research Institute, was aware that there's a big problem with rice that is flooded. So usually rice will die if it's underwater for mm-hmm. 3 days.
Well, a lot of us see rice growing in rice paddies that's flooded.
Yeah.
So what
so
is the difference?
Rice will do quite well in rice paddies, but if it's completely submerged all the way to the tips of the leaves, it'll die within 3 days.
Okay, good.
And that's a big problem in South and Southeast Asia. It's estimated that in India and Bangladesh alone, 4 million tons of rice, which is enough to feed 30 million people, is lost to flooding every year. So my colleague approached me with a puzzle. He said that conventional breeding had failed to introduce flood tolerance into varieties that farmers like, and he proposed that if we could clone the gene, he could do some advanced breeding and bring that gene into farmers, local varieties that are favored by farmers in those areas.
Mm-hmm. So
and
you did?
And so we were successful. My lab cloned the gene, and he was able to carry out advanced breeding techniques with that genetic information and develop varieties that are now tolerant of rice up to 17 days.
Wow. So, Pamela, where did you find a gene that could stand being submerged for 17 days?
So this was an old variety of rice that's not grown anymore. It's found in eastern India,
mm-hmm.
and it's been known to breeders for 50 years.
Oh, so
and
people knew about this.
And the conventional breeding approaches failed to produce varieties that were favored by farmers, and the reason is that lots of other negative traits or deleterious traits were introduced at the same time. So with genetics, you can bring in a very small region of the chromosome, which means bring in just a few genes, and you can conserve the mm-hmm. taste and flavor and agronomic characteristics that farmers like.
So, Pamela and Ronald, you truly are a spear carrier in the Green Revolution, I guess kicked off by Norman Borlaug some time ago, and there you are developing rice that can grow underwater, I guess, for 17 days, which is truly an amazing feat, and thus provide food for 30 million people. That's pretty amazing stuff. Who paves the way for the plant genomics laboratory? I always ask that question of our guests.
Who paves the way? Or
yeah. Who pays the way?
Who pays
who
the
funds,
way?
Who funds the program?
Oh, okay. So my laboratory is funded entirely by nonprofit foundations and government agency. And that particular project, the Submergence Tolerance Project, was funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a government grant, and also by USAID.
Good. Let's go to Raul Adamczyk. Raul, welcome to the Food Chain. You're the student farm manager, UC Davis Student Farm, instructor of organic farming. Welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael.
Talked with a lot of people last night at an event of that had a lot of organic farmers, and you were well spoken by all the people there. You're kind of a pilgrim or a pioneer, at least, of the organic movement here in California. You're in there for a long time, right?
I've been a organic grower for a long time and a advocate of organic farming for a long time. Yeah.
And now you're an instructor of organic farming.
Yeah.
And tell us about UC Davis's small farm, student farm.
Well, first of all, the manager director of the student farm, Mark Van Horen, gets very upset when I get introduced as the manager of the student farm.
Ah.
But I'm the I'm the market garden coordinator.
Okay.
At student farm, and I co-teach a class with Mark on organic production practices. And also, we have a five-acre market garden where we grow vegetables, integrate students into the farming process, and provide produce for a CSA and for the coffee house on campus.
Very good. And we note with interest that the state of California is defunding the University of California's small farm program. What on earth is happening?
Well, that's a huge topic there that involves the university and the legislature and the taxpayers, and I think we have a very dysfunctional government here in California that has lost sight of its priorities.
I would say so. So if we are defunding the small farm program, that would mean that we aren't going to have a much focus on small farms, which to me is a tragedy, but I guess small farmers have always gotten along without the government when it gets right down to it. So welcome to the both of you. You're married with children, and I have to ask, how on earth did you meet?
We met through a mutual friend. One thing about Davis is that it is an Aggie community.
There right.
Many, many people here that are interested in agriculture, and we met through an agricultural friend, and what we have discovered is that we both have not only an interest in agriculture, but an interest in improving agriculture,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the important things we have in common that made it possible for us to write our book, Tomorrow's Table.
right? Well, you know, conservative and liberal, Yankee and Reb, socialist and capitalist, my goodness, or in genetic engineering in organic agriculture, the two have been so disparate, so non-connected. Did the two of you, like, have an mutual epiphany one day that you could actually get along?
You know, not so much that. It's more that we both shared a view that a more sustainable agriculture for the U.S. and for the world was possible, and that we both think that agriculture should be a ecologically based agriculture, but also that it would benefit from using the most improved seed and the best technologies available in order to achieve the goals of sustainable agriculture.
Well, that's well said. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll look at the two agricultures with Raul Adamczyk and also Pamela Ronald and you right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
They are married with children. She is the champion of genetic engineering, and he is the champion of organic farming. These technologies, by law, are not allowed to associate. It's against the law to have genetically engineered organic food, and yet that is the suggestion they put forth in their new book, and we are here to talk about that today. The book is, what is your title of your book? Let's see, I'm going to get Pamela Ronald to ask. What is the title of your new book, Pamela?
Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming Genetics and the Future of Food, and it's coming out in paperback this week.
Good, perfect timing. And so I asked Raul this question, and I'd like to ask you as well. Was there a moment when you realized that your two worlds should be together? Was there a specific moment in time?
So as Ralph said, we're in an agricultural community, and we love plants. And I've always been interested in organic farming and organic food. Ralph's always been interested in plant breeding. And so there was really no time when there was any opposition between the kinds of things we were doing. In fact, when we first started dating, there was not an issue because the USDA National Organic Program standards had not been passed. That it's relatively recent that the NOP indicated that genetically engineered crops were not allowed in organic agriculture.
What was your reaction when that law was passed?
Well, I felt sad for the organic community. I think that they are missing out on a great technology, and I feel bad for the rest of agriculture too, because it sort of puts the concept of improved seed in opposition with farming practices, which is really a false dichotomy.
Because farmers have always been interested in improving their crop performance, right?
Yeah, and so there's a difference sometimes in the public. I think people don't really perhaps know that there's a farming practice, and that can range from completely organic practices where you don't spray any synthetic pesticides or fertilizers, to other types of integrated pest management practices, to a heavy industrial, high input agriculture. So those are all farming practices, but all those farming practices along the whole continuum rely on improved seed. And so the concept of that a particular improved seed should not be allowed in, with a particular farming practice really never made sense from a biological or scientific point of view, I think.
Let's explore the technologies kind of in a quick sort of way for people who are wondering what we're talking about. Let's take organic agriculture and let's Pam, would you pick up organic agriculture, and I'll have Raul do genetic engineering. Maybe that'll be fun.
Oh, you're tricky.
We get better answers.
Yeah, I think so. I know you've written about organic agriculture, Pamela. So what is organic agriculture? What are the parameters that we're talking about?
So organic agriculture really came about in response to a growing awareness that much of our farming system are relying more and more heavily on synthetic pesticides and fertilizers. And organic farmers also use pesticides, but the pesticides they use must be occur in nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the issue with fertilizers is there's quite a bit of runoff into streams, and it really damages our waterways. So organic farming practices really tackled that head on, and I think have made a fantastic contribution to looking at alternative methods for controlling pests. And they use crop rotation, for example. And so I think that we're all better off for the advent of organic farming practices.
What about its limitations?
Well, you know, there are certain diseases that organic farming practices cannot control. So let's take diseases, for example. So most seed that organic farmers use is improved seeds, and it's been introduced with disease-resistance genes, like all seeds. And
mm-hmm.
those genes are very effective in combating certain diseases. But there's some diseases that we have no means of controlling. So,
like flooding, for example, right?
Like what?
Like flooding.
Like flooding, that's actually
not a disease, but, you know.
Exactly, that's a stress. So that's a classic example. Like,
right.
How do you control stress? There's no simple way, and the genetic basis work great.
Another
example is that plants get viral diseases, just like humans get viral diseases. And there often is no organic method or conventional method to control a particular devastating disease. And that's one place where genetic engineering can really be quite useful.
Sure, for example.
So, for example, in the island of Oahu, and about 50 years ago, the entire papaya crop was wiped out by papaya ring spot virus. And the farmers had no way to control the disease, no organic method, no conventional method. So they had to abandon the orchards, and they moved to another island. And a few years later, the same disease hit that island, and the production dropped precipitously.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, a local Hawaiian had been studying this disease, and he is, well, his other plant pathologist had predicted the disease would come to the island, and it was really quite an amazing set of circumstances. Right when the disease hit, he was prepared with a genetically engineered papaya that he distributed free to growers, and his name is Dennis Gonzalez, and he's credited with restoring the papaya industry.
There you go. Let's go to genetic engineering, Ro. Adam Check, what do you think? She had the limitations down pretty good on organic agriculture. Let's talk about the parameters of genetic engineering. What the heck are we talking about here?
Genetically engineered plants are plants where a gene from another plant, or in fact from any living organism, can be put into the plant to give it some desired trait.
Mm-hmm.
So the most widely used traits in the U.S. these days are Roundup Ready. Herbicide tolerant genes have been put into corn and soybeans and cotton and canola. And BT, the BT...
Bacillus thuringiensis.
Bacillus thuringiensis gene, which is gene from the BT bacteria, has been put into corn to give it resistance to a number of insect pests.
And all right. And in doing so, what benefit do we derive?
Well, this is really the crux of the matter here. There is some benefit from these crops as they're grown today, in that there is reduced insecticide use on corn and cotton where the BT gene has been used, and there is with the herbicide tolerant gene, it allows growers to use no-till practices, mm-hmm. which reduces soil erosion, and it's also before. They were using Roundup on these Roundup-ready crops. They were using atrazine and other herbicides that were significantly more toxic.
Or even worse yet, people like me, who was a teenage herbicide when I was growing up. And so instead of having to use people or use much more toxic materials, they can use genes to make a plant not susceptible to... the defoliants, and they therefore they can use less chemicals. That's the idea. And when we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to ask Raul about the limitations of genetic engineering. Pamela was really good with the limitations of organic farming, so we'll see how Raul can do with genetic engineering. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Should we allow genetic engineering into organic agriculture? The law says no, but Raul Adamczyk and Pamela Ronald say yes. They are together, married with children, and they are part of UC Davis Aggie community, which is one of the biggest Aggie communities in the United States. She is at one end of the campus, so to speak, and he is at the other. She is... the chair of the plant genomics program and professor of the same at UC Davis, and he is an instructor and a manager and a big part of the student organic farm at UC Davis. So their technologies have been disallowed by the National Organic Program, relatively recently developed by the United States Department of Agriculture to rein in and control and confine the organic food industry. And the law says that organic food will not be genetically engineered food. So we're exploring their suggestion that perhaps they should be allowed to develop organically, genetically engineered organic foods. And that might make, indeed, for a more sustainable future. So we're exploring that possibility with the two. And we're talking about the limitations of genetic engineering. And Raul is taking that one, and we'll head off into the wild blue yonder with it, Raul. What are the limitations of genetic engineering?
Well, one of the limitations that we see today in the U.S. is how it's used. So presently, as I said, the two most developed traits, BT crops and herbicide-tolerant crops, are used in corn and soybeans, and if you look at the corn and soybean system in the U.S., it's a mess. There's still lots of soil erosion. There's nitrate leaching out of the fields that contaminates water supplies. There's very little biodiversity of crops in the fields. There's very little biodiversity around the fields. It is not a very ecologically based or a sustainable system. And that's one of the reasons why we think that if ecological farming practices were integrated into that system, then the use of genetically engineered crops could provide some benefits. but would also be part of a system that was much more diverse, reduced soil erosion more, reduced energy inputs, reduced other harmful environmental inputs. So in my mind, the biggest problem with genetically engineered plants is how they're being used.
Okay, they're being used in a production system that emphasizes the limitations of genetic engineering, essentially, rather than its benefits. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the genetically engineered traits provides some benefits for those systems, but they don't even come close to making it a sustainable farming system, which is our goal.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phone, folks. The phone number is today, 800-624-2665, 831-4790. Michael Lowson here. Today we're talking about genetically engineered organic foods with Raoul Adamczak, who is the instructor of organic farming, UC Davis, and Pamela Ronald, chairperson of the plant genomics program at UC Davis. Married with children, they are, and they came up with this incredible suggestion that perhaps for a sustainable future, we should have genetically engineered organic food. Let's go to the phone. And we have Richard Merrill, who is a very well-known proponent of organic agriculture here in California. Richard, welcome to the Food Chain.
How you doing? Long time.
Very good. Welcome aboard.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. I wanted to comment on your speaker.
Go right ahead.
Well, everyone would like phytophthora-resistant potatoes and all the wonderful virus-resistant plants, and that's nice in theory. But the real problem is who controls this. And to say these are improved seeds is misleading. What they are is really infective genomes. Genetic engineering is not the same as the traditional trial plant breeding by any means. For one thing, it can't save seeds. And
why can't you save seeds?
Well, because it's against the law.
Okay.
Monsanto controls all of the patents, and if you save seeds, you will get busted, and people who have saved seeds have actually been run out of business. I suggest people watch Food, Inc. to get an idea of what genetic engineering is really all about. We don't know about the consequences. It's not a seed. It's technically, in the case of corn, an airborne genome. And I figure when farmers get put out of business for saving seeds, something is wrong. So, in summary, yes, it's a nice theory, but the real problem is who controls this. And right now, Monsanto and a few other companies have a complete leg up on the control, patent control.
Well, you know, Richard, this and also Raoul and Pamela, this is really where I became fascinated with the whole concept of genetic engineering. I was speaking at a conference in Missouri. And I went to breakfast early one morning at this little cafe across the street and met a farmer there named Percy Smizer. And Percy told me this incredible story about how he woke up one day to the fact that Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola had invaded his farm.
Absolutely.
And what happened was one of the most incredibly bizarre stories I've ever heard. Monsanto heard that its Roundup Ready canola had invaded Percy Smizer's farm, and they sued Percy Smizer.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes, for having misused without paying for their canola, though he never planted it, and in fact had been developing his own seed for 45 years.
Yeah, and it's even more bizarre than that. Try and find organic corn anywhere now. It's extremely difficult because, for example, in Whole Foods, if you go in there, they say, well, we can't guarantee our corn is organic anymore, so they're not selling it.
So if I could, thank you for that question. Maybe I could just clarify
a
couple things. So first of all, the process of genetic engineering does not prevent farmers from saving their seed. So, for example, around the world, most rice farmers save their seed. And if you introduce a gene either through conventional breeding or through genetic engineering, farmers can save their seed. So there's no technical limitation to saving
that's
seed.
Not true.
Wait a minute, let Pamela finish here.
But I think the caller brings up an important point of the concept of a legal limitation of saving your seed. And there's been a lot of focus in the United States on Monsanto, and I think it is really important to think about who controls the germplasm. And when I say germplasm, it means the entire, all the genes in a variety. And the issue is not the process of genetic engineering. The issue is more an antitrust issue. So we know Monsanto in the last 5 or 10 years has bought up something like 20 seed companies.
Yeah.
So when they control the seed that's been developed through conventional breeding, they can control what goes on with that seed. So what I like to
Pam, can you hold that? We have to take a quick hard break. We will be right back. Richard, can you hang with us?
Sure.
All right, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Lolson, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Should we allow genetically engineered crops into organic agriculture? That is a suggestion put forth by Pamela Ronald and Raul Adamczak in their new book. Or in their book just coming out in paperback this week, Organically Grown and Genetically Engineered, The Food of the Future. And that's the question we're talking about. And also with us on the phones, we have Richard Merrill, who has been a leading light of the organic community in California for a long time, as an instructor at Cabrillo College in Aptos, California. So, Pamela, we're addressing, I guess, the issue of ownership and control. I attended a convocation of organic farmers last evening, and I asked them, well, what's wrong with this organic or genetically engineered organic? And to a person, their principal complaint seemed to be the issue of control. And then when you can control, when you own a gene, and that gene can spread with the wind, you can take over the world. As you know, and I guess as proof of that, you can look at the native races of corn throughout Mexico, which are now turning up with Monsanto's Roundup Ready gene infused in that native races of corn. So legally, I guess, Monsanto now owns the corn. So
I think there's a little, what I really like to advocate is to direct political action to where it matters. So I think it does matter. I don't think we want a couple companies controlling the seed supply, whether it's genetically engineered or not.
Amen.
And so that is a legitimate course of action. But I would like to argue that to argue against a scientific process that introduces genes into plants is really a misdirection of effort. So you can introduce genes using very different technologies, conventional breeding,
sure,
genetic engineering. And one important point is that it's a global issue. So right now, most of the genetically engineered crops in the United States are sold by multinational corporations. But if you look globally, very quickly what we're seeing is national technology providers developing new genetically engineered crops for their local markets. And in 5 years, the vast majority of genetically engineered crops are going to be released in the developing world. And the reason that's important, let me just give you one example. There's an example of a new rice coming out that's enriched for vitamin A. It's called golden rice. So these are 500,000 children die every year because they don't have the nutrients, the vitamin A nutrients. And in our world, in Santa Cruz, Davis, Berkeley, we really take our vitamin fortification for granted. We have vitamin D-enriched milk. We have iodized salt. Our children are healthy. We don't see the death and devastation that exists in the rest of the world. And this golden rice is expected to be released in 2 years.
Who's going to own it?
It's in the public domain, and that is something else I think that a caller was a little bit confused about. Rice is selfed by farmers, so the rice is distributed through the national breeding programs. The farmers get the rice. They can self the seed and replant, and it's estimated, even the most negative estimates, if you take the most pessimistic assumptions, it's expected that the lives of 2,000 children will be saved in the first year that rice is released. And so I really feel that it's a moral and a humanitarian issue to think through the use of genetically engineered crops. And that is really the point of our book, is that we want to look at how we can use this incredible technology to benefit the most people and the neediest people.
Okay. Well, Richard Merrill, the lady has a pretty persuasive point. What do you think?
Well, I understood that the issue here was, should American organic agriculture embrace genetic engineering? And if that's the issue, I would say, no, let me finish, please. You've had your day.
Okay.
I would say no. And for a lot of reasons, especially as long as corporations have a litigious control over the seed. And I'm concerned about this country. Now, I need to be realistic. I think, for example, that algae, which will become a potential material for biofuels in the near future, mm-hmm. will be bioengineered. I have no doubt about that. What all organic people are really concerned about, again, is the control issue. And yes, in foreign countries, all that's important. But again, the issue is, should it be in American organic agriculture? And that's the issue, and that's where the control is. Unlike any other country, the corporations control that seed, and if that can be dealt with, then we can start talking about this.
Well, how do you address that in your mind?
Me?
Yeah.
Address what?
Yeah. Well, you know, the focus of our book is really how organic farming practices and genetic engineering can be used to make conventional agriculture more sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
But if I look at organic agriculture, I can see areas where virus resistance, drought stress, mm-hmm. salt tolerance.
But how do you address the issue of control?
Okay. Right, right.
The fact that we've come to a point in the world where one or two companies own the gene pool almost.
Yeah. So that is a huge problem. And I think it's a huge problem whether you have genetically engineered seeds or you just have hybrid seeds. If a few companies are controlling the seed industry, I don't think anyone benefits except those companies. And there are going to be meetings this next year to try and determine if there are antitrust actions that should be taken against the seed industry to make it more competitive.
Okay, quick break, right back with Raul, Pamela, Richard, and Jan's on the line too, so stay tuned. Well, a few minutes left and so many miles to go. Holy smokes. Raul Adamczyk and Pamela Ronald, their new book, which is just coming out in paperback, Organically Grown and Genetically Engineered, The Food of the Future. Richard Merrill, a longtime proponent of organic agriculture here in California, instructor at Cabrillo College, Aptos, California. And hey, we just picked up Jan. Jan, welcome to The Food Chain. Jump right in.
Hi, yes, Michael. And your guest, I've been listening to your program, and the main problem I have with any of this genetically modifying seed is the companies that do it who want to control the seed.
So and that seems to be a pretty common complaint, I guess.
I think we're getting down to good and evil here, and I see certain corporations like Whole Foods who come out and, for the good of people, want to do what's right. You could do with the healthcare thing. The CEO spoke up in favor of what I believe is right. Now I've seen Monsanto. For years I've heard terrible things about this company, wanting to control our lives. You know, they want to control our food, our water, our land, and everything. And then they want to take our defenses, way of defending ourselves away from us.
No, with all due respects, Jan, I don't think they want to control all of those things. I just think that they want to control the genetics of seeds,
well,
and then the rest of it kind of falls into place, you know?
Well, then, yes, but then you have other companies that are controlling us, pharmaceuticals or other things.
Yeah.
I think it's we're getting down to a question of good and evil. Why is this done? If it's done truly for humanitarian purposes, then the seed should be available to everybody. All of this should, everything should be available to everyone.
Well, there you go.
If we go for the good, we could have the Garden of Eden.
Thank you very much, Jan. I have to run really quickly. I want to ask Pamela one quick question. Most of the complaints seem to be with respect to the control, but what about the issue of manufacturing a Frankenstein? As a scientist, I'm sure you've thought about this. What if we take the genes from two different species and fuse them together and come up with something that runs amok?
Well, first, I think both callers are advocating public funding for research for the public good, and I'm all for that. So,
okay, good.
Let's go for that. And because I think we do need to depend on governmentally funded programs to benefit the greatest good. So corporations, Monsanto, their goal is to make a profit. And that's good for the economy, but it's not always going to feed the world. So that's one thing. And the second thing is that the National Academy of Sciences has looked at the issue of introducing genes through genetic engineering compared to introducing genes through conventional breeding. And they have very clearly stated that the risks of unintended consequences are similar. So if you bring in a gene through conventional breeding, you're not exactly sure what you're going to end up with. The risk of any harm occurring is very low, but you can't exactly predict what's going to happen.
Okay, Richard, do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that.
Okay, out of time, folks.
May I suggest people get Genetic Engineering and Agriculture by Miguel Altieri and read that book.
Thank you very much, Richard. Appreciate your contribution today.
Good work, buddy.
And thanks especially to Mr. and Mrs. Pamela Ronald and Raul Adamczyk for joining us today. Their book just out this week in paperback, Organically Grown and Genetically Engineered, The Food of the Future. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you all out there for tuning in The Food Chain. Remember, if you didn't get a chance to ask a question or make a comment, log them on the discussion page at metrofarm.com. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.